Good evening, everybody. My name is Zachary Weber. I'm the staff educator of adult programs here at the Science Center. And before we begin tonight, I know you're all anxious to learn about the science behind zombies. Just a couple of announcements before we get started. We intend Cafe Sad to be a very casual, laid-back experience, so we encourage you to bring food and drink in with you if you like. We have no problems with that. The bar and cafe will stay open until about 8:30, so if you want to get up and get something else to drink or use the restroom, feel free. We're not going to be offended. Keep it relaxed and casual. If you do need to use the restrooms, they're most easily accessible through the doors on this side of the auditorium. You go out those doors, the restrooms are directly on your right. One more announcement before we start. We've started recording our Cafe Sci series to make a podcast. So if you've missed previous events and want to hear them, you can find them online. You can find a link to our podcast on the Cafe Sci webpage on the Carnegie Science Center website. Or if you saw the slides beforehand, it's carnegiescienceCenter.podomatic.com. We'll get you there as well. And this lecture should be up there in the next couple of days as soon as I have time to get it online. If this is your first Cafe Sci, just a little rundown of how the evening will run. We'll get our speaker going here in a couple minutes. He'll give his lecture, which will last 45 minutes to an hour, somewhere in there. We'll take a short 10 to 15 minute intermission. You can use the restroom, get something else to drink, whatever you need to do, stretch your legs. And then we'll meet back here at around 8 o'clock for the Q&A portion of the evening. And I'll go into a little bit more detail of how the Q&A will work when we get there. We just ask that if you do have a question, try to save it for the Q&A so everybody can hear it, and so we can give our speaker a little bit of a break as well. So don't rush the stage. Hold your questions until the Q&A. All right, so let's get going tonight. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Timothy Versteinen. He'll be bringing us his presentation, The Living Dead Brain, What Human Brains Teach Us About Zombie Minds. He's coming to us from Carnegie Mellon University. And I know we're all excited about zombies on TV and in movies, and this will be about zombies, but there also is real science in there, even if zombies aren't technically real. The science is real, so hopefully everybody enjoys it. Join me in welcoming Dr. Versteinen.
Thanks, Zach. Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay, good. I'd like to thank Cafe Sci for inviting me out. This is a wonderful opportunity, and it's a great science outreach endeavor. I like events like this, and I hope my enthusiasm carries through, and you guys enjoyed this as well. Now, before I actually get into the nitty-gritty of the talk, I just want to do a little disclaimer. I'm going to be showing clips from zombie movies, so there's going to be some gore, a little bit of violence, that kind of thing. It's all PG-13, so it should be okay, but for anybody who might not like zombie movies or have never seen one before, you might want to close your eyes when the videos start. Also, obviously, zombies aren't real yet, but the science we're going to be talking about today is 100% real. So all the brain-behavior relationships I'm going to be discussing is real. So even though the organism we're talking about is fantastical, the science isn't. So I'm a professor in psychology and neuroscience at Carnegie Mellon University. And being a professor, that means I've got two roles. I'm a scientist and I'm an educator, which means that I study and I teach. And I like to break these down into a day job and a night job. Now, for my day job, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. And that means that I study how it is our brains give rise to our thoughts, our actions, our perceptions. And for me, this is kind of an ideal job. And that's because I'm a nerd. And I'm a very specific type of nerd. I see I have a lot of fellows in the audience. I'm a science fiction nerd. And growing up, I loved science fiction. Movies, television shows, books, comic books, you name it. If it was available, I read it or watched it. And I caught myself being attracted to very specific themes that kept coming up again and again in the science fiction genre. So, for example, themes like cybernetics, the melding of biology and machine, consciousness, what it means for an entity to be aware of itself and intelligence, mind control and mind reading, how is it that we can read the thoughts of others and maybe even control the thoughts of others. And all these things fascinated me. And it got me to thinking about what it means to think and what it means to be cognitive being or an intelligent being, and that led for me to go into the field of research that I study today. Now, when I was in high school and in college, you know, digging really deep into this science fiction genre, all of these topics were held strictly in the purview of science fiction. They only existed in the minds of science fiction writers. But now, today, these topics are being addressed in modern science. We're dealing with issues of mind reading, mind control, brain stimulation, cybernetics. Let me give you just a flavor of this type of research that's being done here in Pittsburgh today. Meet Jan. This woman here, lying in bed, is Jan. She's been paralyzed from the neck down for years. She suffers a debilitating disease that causes her body to eat away the neurons that control her movements. So she's been wheelchair-bound for, I think, over a decade now. Last year, scientists at the University of Pittsburgh implanted electrical recording devices in Jan's brain, in particular in the area of the brain that is responsible for our movements. And using these neural signals, scientists are controlling a robotic arm. So they're feeding signals from her brain into this robotic arm. And she's starting to gain a little bit of independent control. So for example, last November, Jan fed herself chocolate for the first time in years. You can see her shaking the hand of the lead researcher on the project here. So this is cybernetics in action. We've even got stranger things that science fiction authors never even dreamed of. There's a whole field developing called optogenetics. I lovingly call this virus-guided laser neurons. In optogenetics, what we do is we take viruses, we re-engineer them, and we inject them into the brains of rodents. And these viruses reprogram the living neurons in the animal's brain. What this allows us to do is to turn neurons on and off instantaneously using nothing but light. We can turn a neuron on if we shine a green light and turn it off if we shine a blue light. This gives us a fantastic amount of control over the animal's brain. Now, this is still in its infancy, but the potential for this type of technology is incredible. We could do things like simulate artificial sensory experiences. Think the Matrix. This is just starting, and this is being done by several labs here, both at Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh. Now, we can't use this type of technology in humans yet, but we can stimulate human brains, and we do every day. This is a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS for short. And there are several labs, both at Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh, that are doing this technology now. What it is we use a transient magnetic wave to stimulate the brain. We just put a wand over your head, a pulse of magnetic waves crosses your scalp and stimulates the neurons. And using this technology, we can turn the neuron excitability up or down in different areas. We can change whether or not an area is more likely to be on or more likely to be off. And this allows us to probe how different brain regions are responsible for controlling behavior or guiding our thoughts. But this also has a rich clinical potential as well. We can use this type of brain stimulation in, say, patients with depression to regulate those emotional areas that might not be functioning as properly. So there's a rich potential in brain stimulation today in humans. We can also read your mind. So, for example, this is a project that's being done by a fellow named Adrian Nestor over at Carnegie Mellon University. And what Adrian does is he'll put people in the fMRI scanner and start showing them pictures like what you see on the screen, these little kind of hairless faces, if you will. And all Adrian does is present you these images and tell you to watch them. And he records the neural responses in your brain as you're watching these images. Then what he does is he takes a computer algorithm and tries to decode the neural responses that he's seeing with the fMRI and reconstruct what you're seeing. So if he presents you with images like this, the computer algorithm will spit out images like this using his neural responses. So we can literally read your mind, see what you're seeing. This is fantastic stuff. Now, I do a kind of a little bit of fMRI research, but I'm primarily interested in something a little bit deeper. I'm the head of the Cognitive Axon Laboratory. Now, cognitive axon might not mean much for those of you who don't eat, drink, and sleep neuroscience. So let me kind of decompose it for you. Cognition, the act of thinking, mental processes. That one we should all be familiar with. Axon's a little bit more difficult. Now, we all know that your brain is comprised of billions of cells that look like this. This is a neuron. In neuroscience, we break down neurons into two basic parts. The gray matter is what takes inputs from other cells and performs a computation, and the output, which we call white matter, is what transmits that decision to other neurons. This little long tube here is called an axon. It's essentially a biological wire, and it allows this neuron to communicate with other neurons at different parts of the brain. So my lab is interested in how the architecture of these axons in the brain, essentially your brain's wiring diagram, leads to your cognitive processes, how it is that our brain's wiring leads us to think. Now, you can think about this problem by analogy. Let's say you wanted to understand the energy dynamics of the United States. One option for you is to go up to the International Space Station and look at the nighttime sky above the United States. You'll get a map that looks like this. Okay? You get local light intensities from different cities across the United States, and you can use the intensity of the light over different cities as a measure of energy usage. New York's going to be very bright, Oklahoma's going to be fairly dark, where I'm from, New Mexico, is going to be pretty well dark. And it gives you a good sense of local energy usage. But if I wanted to know how excess energy, say, from New York gets to Pittsburgh, well, I don't know how that happens. I can't see that with these kind of images. These kind of images here are essentially what we do with fMRI in science. We look at local regional resources that are being used as your brain's doing a computation. But we can't tell where that information is going. To keep with my analogy of the US electric grid, you need to understand where the wires are. You need to see where those connections are. And that's what I do in my lab every day. We're using an advanced technology called diffusion-weighted imaging to build maps of the wiring diagram of the human brain. The maps look something like this. What you're seeing here is a rendering of the physical connections in a living human brain. These are 250,000 connections. Each little line that you see here, each little technicolor fiber, shows a physical connection between one brain area and another. We can now use this map to understand how our brains are wired and look at how these wiring of our individual brains leads to differences in behavior. How, say, disorganized wires might lead to disorganized thoughts, or changes in the integrity of the wires of our brain might change the integrity of our thoughts or our actions. Now, this wasn't even available when I was in graduate school, and I wasn't in graduate school that long ago. So all of these new technologies are being developed that were just science fiction not too long ago. Now, this is the world that I live in for my day job, a world of science inspired by science fiction. But like I said, I have two roles. I'm a scientist, and I'm an educator. And for my educator side, I kind of like to flip this relationship here. What I want to do now is use science to inspire science fiction. Actually, what I really want to do is use science fiction to teach science. Right? So that leads to my night job, and this is why you're all really here, right? In my night job, I'm a zombie scientist. Thank you. Don't tell my tenure committee this. Really, this is a melding of two passions of mine that I share with a good friend and colleague who's a collaborator on this project, Bradley Wojtek. Brad and I were graduate school buddies together, and we had two mutual passions. We loved neuroscience and we loved zombies. And we figured out a way, after many, many, many hours of watching zombie movies and many, many more beers, how we could merge these two together. Now, to do this, I'm going to have to take you on a little journey. Okay. So what I want you to do is all kind of go with me from the Pittsburgh of the present, the relatively safe Pittsburgh now, into the hopefully not so near future of the post-zombie apocalypse world. Okay? And we're going to talk about the science of surviving and understanding the zombie apocalypse. So we now live in a world where zombies are running around, and as a scientist, we want to understand how and why it is that zombies behave the way they do. In order to solve a problem, you have to understand it. Well, the first thing you could do is just simply observe. The art of observation has been around for centuries. And in fact, it was specialized, really, by the military. And you can learn a lot through simple observation. Let's hear what a military man would learn simply from observing zombies.
He's telling me he'll never bake bread, plant crops, raise livestock. He's telling me he's futureless. And eventually he'll tell me how long the infected take to starve to death.
So just simply by observing the behaviors of zombies, you can learn a lot about them. Now, I'm not a military guy, so I'm not looking for weaknesses. I'm looking for root causes. And if you watch lots and lots of zombie movies like I have, and I hope many of you have too, you start to see a convergence of many similar symptoms again and again and again. And these vary a little bit depending on the movie, which we'll go over to in a little bit. But you tend to see problems in visual recognition, attention, impulse control, aggression, memory, language deficits, motor deficits, all kinds of similar deficits that we can now unpackage. Because as a neuroscientist, these are informative to me. These tell me something about what's going on in the zombie brain. So what we want to do is try to find the root of this disorder. Now, to do this, what we're going to really need to do is redefine zombieism, right? Because zombieism has a kind of supernatural flavor to it, and I'm a scientist. So what we're going to do is we're going to package it nice into a nice clean acronym. So we're no longer going to refer to zombieism as zombieism, but as CDHD. Consciousness Deficit Hypoactivity Disorder. This is characterized by the loss of rational, voluntary, and conscious behavior that's replaced by delusional impulsive regression, stimulus-driven attention, and the inability to coordinate motor or linguistic behaviors. I mean, if this is as dry of a definition of zombies you get, you've got a good science definition. We're also working with Merck to formulate a series of pharmaceuticals for this, but that's a whole other topic. All right, so now we've got a good, clean definition of zombieism as CDHD. Next, what we want to do is try to understand its roots. And to understand how these behaviors change, we have to look at the organ that drives all of our behaviors, our brains. And we live in a world where we can take snapshots of the brain using MRI. So what my colleagues and I did is we decided that we were going to go out to the Monroeville Mall, grab a few zombies, bring them back into the lab, and scan their brains. And this is what it looks like to try to scan a zombie. So this big circular thing here, that's an MRI. It's a giant magnet that allows us to take pictures of your brain. And this little gurney, guy in the gurney here, that's one of our zombie critters about ready to go into the MRI. I would show you a picture, but there's something about the growing zombie rights movement that I have to kind of watch out for. Now, we ran into a problem very early on. Unlike what you see on shows like House or any kind of medical drama where they have people having long conversations while they're in the MRI scanner, movements for us are bad. If you're moving around talking while we're trying to take a picture of your brain, all we see is a blurry image. We can't see anything at all. And that's problematic because, let's face it, zombies aren't the most compliant of subjects, right? They're always trying to bite your head off. So we kind of went to great lengths trying to figure out how to stabilize a zombie's head. And the solution actually originated back with the original zombies, going back into post-colonial Haiti. In Haiti, in the voodoo culture, voodoo priests would poison certain victims with a neurotoxin called tetrodotoxin. Tetrodotoxin is found in various plants and animals, but has high concentrations in the pufferfish, in the sex organs of the pufferfish. And if you get doused with tetrodotoxin, you get poisoned with tetrodotoxin, what happens is that the neurons in your body, particularly the neurons in your muscle, lose the ability to fire. It blocks what are called sodium channels in the neurons, and it keeps them from firing properly. So if you get a substantial dose, what happens is you get this loss of muscle control, and it primarily affects the neurons in your muscles, not in your brain. And so a little bit of a dose, you get paralyzed. You get too much, and what happens is one critical muscle, your diaphragm, stops working, and you suffocate to death. But if you get a sublethal dose, your breathing is so faint, your heart beats so faint, that you look like you're dead. And in the Haitian voodoo culture, the loved ones of the victim would think that they were dead, so they'd be buried. But the voodoo doctor knew better, and he would wait outside the grave until the tetrodotoxin wore off, dig his victim back up, and in that culture, he is now a slave to the voodoo priest. Now, I'm not interested in making slaves, but I am interested in having compliant, still subjects. So what we did is we administered sublethal doses of tetrodotoxin to our zombie subjects, and that gave us a very compliant, very still subject. So now we can take pictures of the zombie brain and try to relate what we see in these pictures back to zombie behavior. Do you guys want to see the first ever picture of a zombie brain? All right, good. So what you're going to see is the zombie brain on the right and a normal human brain on the left. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a zombie brain. This is a normal human brain. And what you notice right off the bat is that the zombie brain is missing a lot of key features. There are lots of holes where there should be clear tissue. So this isn't random. This isn't just some arbitrary set of brain damage. Each one of these regions that are lost relates back to a specific symptom we see in individuals affected with CDHD. So what I want to do now is go through a series of symptoms and link it back to the brain damage that we're seeing in the zombie brain. So let's walk through a few well-known symptoms, shall we? I think the first thing we can all agree on when we see zombies is that they're pretty angry. And let me show you what I mean by that. I think we all can agree that he's pretty angry, right? And they call this guy the calm one. So what kind of aggression is this? This is actually a very specific subtype of aggression called impulsive reactive or reactive impulsive aggression. This is a stimulus-driven, irrational, aggressive response. So it's a sudden, heightened, enduring, or inappropriate aggressive response. This is the kind of aggression you get with road rage. Okay? Somebody cuts you off, you get really angry, you stimulate the body's fight or flight response, and it's a very primitive kind of response. It's much different than what you get with the cold, calculated rage of, say, like a school shooting. Right? So you have to disentangle those. Now, the interesting thing about reactive impulsive aggression is that it's a very old circuit. So lots of animals have this same circuit, which means we know a lot about the neural systems that regulate this type of behavior. Let me walk you through a simple schematic of it. Okay. In the front of your head, you have an area called the frontal cortex. And a part of this frontal cortex is called the orbital frontal cortex. It sits basically right here above your eyeballs. And the orbital frontal cortex is the calm, logical kind of controller of your behavior. And it really tries to keep in line and make rational decisions. Part of what it does is regulate an area of the brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is sometimes called the crocodile brain. It regulates a lot of very impulsive kind of behaviors, fight or flight, you can think. And it does this through a coordinated network of brain regions that include areas called the thalamus and the hypothalamus. They go all the way back to a very deep old area of the brain called the periaqueductal gray matter, or PAG. The PAG is what stimulates your autonomic nervous system, which is what stimulates your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system and keeps you getting ramped up and calms you back down. Okay, so it's a very primitive system. And the amygdala is kind of the guy who wants to set it all in motion, whereas the orbital frontal cortex is the guy keeping everything in line. But if you wipe away the orbital frontal cortex, if you get rid of it, what happens is you have an overactive amygdala circuit, which means that this guy is going to receive less control every time somebody cuts you off in traffic. It's going to stimulate all these other connections and lead to greater enhanced responses. So what you get with orbital frontal damage are more impulsive rage, chronic stress response, appetite dysregulation. Sound familiar? So let's take a look at this circuit in zombies, shall we? Well, as I said before, the orbital frontal cortex sits right above your eyeballs. So this is a human brain. You're looking at the front and underneath. And this is where normal orbital frontal cortex sits. Whereas in the zombie brain, we see that there's a complete loss of the orbital frontal cortex. We see a lot of the tissue's just gone. So that regulator of the behavior is out of commission. Now, what about the other areas? Well, if we look at the size of the amygdala and the hypothalamus and the thalamus, we see that by and large, their volume is much bigger in zombies than they are in normal humans. So you've lost that kind of calm, controlling brain area, and you've enlarged these very aggressive primitive circuits. So that means there's this hypersensitization of the fight or flight response, but particularly the fight response in zombies. And that's where you get this impulsive rage in zombies. Okay, let's look at another symptom. I want you to pay careful attention here. I'm sorry about the lighting here. You're going to see a clip of a zombie who used to be a gas attendant in his previous life.
trying to be us.
No, they used to be us. Learning how to be us again.
No way. Some germ or some devil got those things up and walking, but there's a big difference between us and them. They're dead. It's like they're pretending to be.
It's like they're pretending to be us, he says. Let me walk you through what you just saw. So this high school couple zombies walk across the gas station bell, and they trigger a well-learned response from the gas attendant zombie. He walked out, grabbed the gas nozzle, turned around, and then was like, what am I doing here? Why am I here? How did I get here? It was as if he forgot what he was doing by the time he got to the gas nozzle. Now, this is a very common behavior that you see in patients with anterior grade amnesia. Anterior grade amnesia is the inability to encode new memories for more than a brief period of time. You live moment by moment in a short-term memory. This is very different than the type of amnesia you see, unfortunately, a lot of in soap operas, right? Where you hit your head, you forget who you are, you decide you're going to run away with this Latin lover, you know. That's actually rare, if real at all. Whereas anterior grade amnesia is a very common disorder. It's seen in a lot of dementias. And we know a lot about the neural circuitry behind this long-term encoding of memories, thanks in large part to a classic patient in the neurological literature named HM. This is HM here. HM, as a young man, suffered from debilitating epilepsy. So in his 20s, he was having dozens of epileptic seizures a day. They were risking his life. So surgeons decided to remove the tissue that was the source of the epilepsy, which happened to be an area of the brain called the medial temporal lobe. This, let's see if this works. This is the medial temporal lobe in HM after his surgery. You see these holes here? They took out a central part in the mid part of the brain. This is a control brain here that still has tissue there for comparison. So after HM recovered, the doctors noticed that he always lived moment by moment. Even though he had the same doctor for 30 or 40 years, he introduced himself to the doctor every single day. He had no idea that he had met this doctor before. He had lost all abilities to encode any new memories. Now, anybody who's seen the movie Memento has seen this in action. Memento was a great example of anterior grade amnesia. In this movie, Guy Pearce plays a character who has all these cues for himself. He tattoos things he needs to remember on his body. He leaves notes for himself because he can't remember things for more than a few minutes. And it was a really great example of this type of brain damage. Now, the specific part of the medial temporal lobe that encodes new memories is an area called the hippocampus. This is the hippocampus circled in a normal human brain. It's a seahorse-shaped area that's very deep in the brain. Now, let's take a look at the hippocampus in zombies. If you look at the hippocampus in zombies, bilaterally, which means both in the left and right hemisphere, they're gone, which means that zombies can't encode new memories, which is why they just always seem forgetful and can be distracted. Because as soon as they get on a new thought pattern, as soon as they're moving towards a new victim, they've forgotten about you. So zombies have really horrible memories. Now, I'd like to take this moment for a little history of neuroscience footnote, because I love neuroscience. All the areas that I've been talking about so far, the orbital frontal cortex, the amygdala, the hippocampus, are all key players in a classic circuit in neuroscience known as the circuit of Pates. This is the circuit of Pates here. The circuit of Pates was a theoretical circuit proposed by this man here, James Pates. James Pates was interested in how it is that emotional memories are remembered really well, whereas boring old everyday memories aren't really remembered that well. How it is that we all remember where we were when we first heard about 9/11, but we can't remember what we did at the store yesterday. So he proposed that there must be a network of brain areas that talk to each other, emotional areas and memory areas, and they have to all be linked together in order for this kind of emotional regulation of memories. So this was back in 1935. And to test his theory, Dr. Pates did the only thing he could do at the time. He took the rabies virus and injected it into the brains of cats. Now, what this does is the rabies virus, when it attacks one region, it starts to infect other regions by traveling up those axons I talked about before, right? It follows up those axons and infects another region. by following the rabies infection, you can see brain areas that are connected to each other. So he tested out his theory about the circuit by injecting the rabies virus in different parts of the cat's brain and seeing where it traveled. Now, as a consequence of his research, Dr. Papes created cats that suffered from aggression problems, impulsivity, memory problems, appetite problems. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Dr. Papes came up with the first zombie cats. Okay, so little history and neuroscience footnote. I'm glad they didn't take over the world, although it would have been cute. Okay, next up, language. Let's face it, zombies aren't fluent. Let me show you an example of the most fluent zombie in the zombie literature. Meet Tarman.
Who's there?
Now, notice what Tarman did. He didn't say, come here so that I can eat your brains. He didn't ask, may I please eat your brain? He just said, brains. And the point was pretty well taken, right? So what he did is he distilled down what he was saying to the key point. This resembles a symptom we see in some neurological patients, which is called telegraphia. Telegraphia is when people just say the key idea, the key words to get their point across, because they're having difficulty saying the words. This is a symptom of a disorder known as aphasia. Aphasia is a global deficit in language, and you generally have two types. You have the inability to produce language, which is Broca's, and the inability to comprehend language, which is called Wernicke's area. And these are two very different types of aphasia. If you get them together, you get something called global aphasia, which means you've lost all communication abilities. And these are isolated not only in how they affect behavior, but in their neural representations. So if we look at a normal human brain, Broca's area sits right here in this area highlighted in blue. It's basically up over your left temple. And if you damage this, what happens is you can understand what people are saying or what you're reading fine, but you can't say what you want to say, and you can't write it. Your production of language is gone. Wernicke's area, on the other hand, sits back here, okay, and it's shown in green. And it's right over your left ear, like right at the top of your left ear here. You damage Wernicke's, you can say what you want to say fine, you can't understand what people are saying or what you're reading. Now, these two are connected to each other through a major pathway, so they talk to each other a lot. And you can think about them as being like two cities. One that manufactures a product, and another that ships it out to the rest of the world. If you damage either part of the circuit, you're going to get a language deficit. So let's see this circuit in the zombie brain, shall we? If we look at zombies, we see that both Wernicke's area and Broca's area are substantially deteriorated. So zombies can't understand you, and they can't talk back. So don't try having a conversation with a zombie, no matter what that movie Warm Bodies says. Okay, next up, let's take a look at the kind of delusional behaviors we see in sometimes zombies. How is it that even though they were your high school sweetheart, your next door neighbor that you've known for decades, as soon as somebody turns into a zombie, they don't recognize you? In fact, they only really look at how you move. Let's take a look at an example of humans who are using this to their advantage. Okay, now keep in mind that herd of zombies was their neighbors, the people who drank at the same bar as them before the apocalypse happened. But the zombies don't recognize them. They don't really see them. And in fact, as long as the humans are moving like zombies, the zombies don't think that they're humans, right? It's as if they're not recognizing their faces. They're only judging an identity based on how the people are moving. If you're moving like a zombie and you're groaning like a zombie, therefore you must be a zombie. Now, that inability to recognize people you know well resembles a classic psychiatric delusion known as Capgras delusion. This is also known as the invasion of the body snatchers delusion. Okay? This is the false belief that the people you know well have been replaced by imposters and typically seen of as a threat. That's not my wife. That's an alien in my wife's skin, right? Now, Capgras delusion is relatively rare, and we don't know a lot about its underlying neural roots. But we do know a lot about the neural roots of a similar disorder in the neurological literature called prosopagnosia. Prosopagnosia is the inability to recognize faces. You can see the nose, you can see the lips, you can see the ears, you can see the eyes, you can see the hair color, but you can't put it together to recognize a person you've known for years. Now, prosopagnosia recently got a lot of attention in the news because apparently Brad Pitt said he's prosopagnosic, which we don't know if that's true yet. But prosopagnosia arises from damage to a very particular area of the brain that we know a lot about. So to see a face and recognize a face involves the recruitment of a lot of areas that sit right at the underside of your brain. This is known as the core face network. So if I put you in the fMRI scanner and I show you this picture of this face here, and I record the neural responses in your brain and compare it to when I'm showing you, say, pictures of a house or pictures of a car, what you get is a network of brain regions that light up, shown here, all these little blobs or areas of the brain that respond more to this face than to these objects. Now, these areas, the core face network, are all linked together by a serial chain of connections that all allow information to process from the back of the brain, which is involved in recognizing features, all the way up to the front of the brain, which is where the end goal identity is stored. So if you lesion any part along this path, you're going to have an impairment of recognizing faces. Let me show you a really interesting example of this in effect. So what you're going to see is a patient who's about ready to undergo neurosurgery. He has a tumor that needs to be cut out. And it sits in a part of the brain near that core face network. So what the neurosurgeons at Stanford are going to do is they're going to implant electrodes on the underside of his brain near these face regions and stimulate different parts of this network and just ask him what happens. What they want to do is they want to find those face areas and tell the neurosurgeons, don't cut that unless you have to, so that he doesn't become prosopagnosic. So you're going to see two trials here. The first one is going to be a fake trial. He doesn't know that there's not going to be any stimulation delivered. The second trial is when they actually deliver stimulation. Let's see what he reports.
Okay, just look at my face and tell me what happens when I do this, all right?
Okay.
One, two, three.
Nothing.
Nothing? Okay. I'm going to do it one more time. Look at my face. One, two, three.
You just turned into somebody else.
Tell me
your face metamorphosis. Your nose got saggy, went to the left. You almost looked like somebody I'd seen before, but somebody different. That was a trip.
Another line. I wonder if we can market that as a recreational drug. So I don't have enough time to show you the rest of that clip, but it goes on. They start turning down the stimulation level. So they're just disrupting it less and less and less. And at some point, he says, your face didn't change. I just didn't recognize who you are. And keep in mind, he's been staring at this person for days. He knows the experimenter well. So it just shows that if you disrupt any part along the circuit, you're going to get this deficit in recognizing faces. Now, the area that they stimulated is known as the fusiform face area. It sits on a very under part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus. Let's take a look at the fusiform gyrus in our zombie brains. Now, this is the zombie on the right and the human on the left. This is a slice through the brain just like this. And this area here that has now a giant hole is where the fusiform face area should be in the zombie brain. And it's gone. But it's only gone on one side, on the right side, which is a hemisphere specialized for seeing faces. So zombies are really horrible at recognizing who you are, and they go off of these other cues: how you move, how you grunt, how much blood you have over you, how rotted your flesh is. All these things that tell them who you are and whether or not you're a zombie or a human. Okay, so zombies can't see faces, but that's not the only visual problem that they have. Let's take a look at another visual symptom that we see in zombies all the time.
How come you guys always go out at night? Wouldn't it be safer in the daytime?
Fireworks, kid. Dentists can't keep their eyes off them.
Okay, so in the rest of this clip, what happens is they keep shooting out the fireworks, and the humans start going around scavenging supplies in the zombie-infected area because the zombies are just distracted. Every time a firework goes off, they're staring at it, and they're not paying attention to the more quiet humans that are moving around them. This kind of inability to disengage from these very salient stimuli is something known as disengagement deficit. Disengagement deficit is the difficulty from reallocating attention from a more salient stimulus. It's going to be annoying, I apologize. But if I keep doing this, you guys can still hear what I'm saying. You can still pay attention to my voice, even though there's a more salient stimulus happening. People with disengagement deficit won't hear my voice. They'll always be paying attention to this because they can't disengage from that more salient stimulus. Now, this disorder happens from damage to a very particular area of the brain called the posterior parietal cortex, which rests right here on the human brain. This is the side view of the human brain. This is the back top part. It's right up in here. So if you get damage to this, and particularly severe damage in both hemispheres, you get this disengagement deficit, to the point where sometimes patients with bilateral damage to the parietal lobe only see one thing at a time. If I show them a pen, they only see the pen. They don't see anything else. And as long as they're paying attention to it, only the pen exists. It's a symptom called simultagnosia. So if you damage this parietal cortex, it's going to lock you into these very stimulus-engaging attention. And if you look at the zombie brain, as you would expect, we get this bilateral damage in the dorsal parietal cortex. So we get this damage in these areas that are responsible for reallocating your visual attention. And that's why you can distract a zombie with something like a firework or a flash grenade. Okay, so let's go over the final symptom of zombies, and probably the most notable but most controversial. What I want you to do is pay attention to how these zombies are moving, in particular how they're walking. Ready? He's gone. All right, future subject. So I want you to notice, all the zombies were moving like this. They had a wide stance, their arms were wide, and they did kind of a stiff-legged, lumbered walk. Now, a lot of people, when they try to think about the movement of zombies, say that zombies move like patients with Parkinson's disease, a well-known motor dysfunction. But I want to put that to rest. Let me show you how a patient with advanced Parkinson's disease moves. They tend to have a slouched posture, profound curvature of the spine, and their movements are like this. The arms are by the side, and it's a slow shuffling walk. That's not what we see in zombies. Zombies have an upright posture, wide stance, and kind of a clumsy, lumbering walk. That type of movement resembles another neurological disorder known as spinal cerebellar ataxia. This is the inability to produce smooth and coordinated actions. It usually results in lumbering movements, balance problems, or tremors. It even involves slurred speech and problem seeing. Now, spinal cerebellar ataxia patients have this wide stance lumbering walk. And that's because a particular area of the brain that's involved in motor coordination and balance is being attacked by the body. And that's an area called the cerebellum. The cerebellum sits in the back of your head. Again, this is a side view of the brain. This is the butt of the brain. It's a really cute butt. It looks like a little bit of cauliflower stuffed in the back of the head. That's the cerebellum. It's actually almost an independent little brain. Over half of the neurons in the entire brain rest in this little guy here. So it does this profound computation, and it's involved in language, visual perception, but most notably, motor control. Now, if anybody had a few too many drinks at the bar tonight or have had too many drinks on the south side, that balance problems you get, the slurred speech, the stumbling walk, that's the alcohol affecting your cerebellum. So you've all felt what it's like a little bit to be ataxic. Because when you get too drunk, those symptoms are all cerebellar. So these kinds of movements resemble what we see in zombies. Let's take a look at the zombie brain. Now, in the zombie, the cerebellum should be right here. And notice that it's completely gone. So cerebellar or zombie movements appear to be cerebellar in nature. They appear to be due to a deficit in basically not having a cerebellum. So they're going to have this kind of drunken stance. That also might explain why they have very mumbly speech. Okay, now, how many hardcore zombie enthusiasts do I have in the audience? It's okay to raise your hand. Okay, good. Nice. Are there only slow zombies? No. What's the other type? Fast, yeah. Or in the case of World War Z, ultra fast. So the slow variant of CDHD was first seen outside of Pittsburgh about 45 years ago and has been established as the preeminent form of the disorder. This is the first set of patients out here. But more recently, in England and Milwaukee and pretty soon all over the world, we're seeing the fast zombie variant appear. And obviously, there must be something different about their brains, because they can run, they can climb, they have better spatial abilities, they're less distractible. So something must be going on in their brains that's different than what we see in the slow zombie brain. So my colleagues and I flew out to England, snatched ourselves a few fast zombies. It's much more difficult than you would think. Brought them back into the lab and did the same procedure. We put them in the scanner, gave them chototoxin, and looked at their brain structure. And if we compare the brain of a fast zombie to that of a slow zombie, here's the slow zombie, here's the fast zombie, we notice two interesting features. First, the fast zombies have an intact cerebellum. Hence, they have better motor coordination abilities. In addition, their posterior parietal cortex, that guy up here, is intact as well. So they're less distractible. They also have better spatial abilities. So this is what makes the fast zombies such a vicious predator. They don't have as extensive of brain damage as the slow zombie variant. So my colleagues and I were trying to figure out, why do you have these two subtypes? Why do you have one type that has extensive brain damage and another that has intact areas in the back of the head? So we came up with what we call the time to resurrection hypothesis. Let me walk you through it. Okay. As soon as you die, your blood stops moving, your brain gets starved of resources, which is problematic. The brain is essentially the US of the energy supply of the body. Even though it takes up 2% of the volume, it uses 20% of the oxygen, 25% of the glucose. It just sucks on all these resources. And once it's starved, it starts deteriorating fast. So after a little bit of time, you only have a little bit of brain damage until you resurrect, start eating again, and presumably some form of blood starts moving. If it takes you a long time to resurrect, let's say minutes, hours, or days, you're going to have more extensive brain damage, which is going to cause more severe symptoms. Now, we didn't have an easy way to test this hypothesis. We had a rather tragic way. We worked with undergraduate research assistants, and they're not known for adhering to protocol. So, as you will, you know, the undergraduates are distractible. Sometimes they'd put their hands in the cages, and we'd have an unfortunate accident. But over time, we had a good set of subjects from which we could test this hypothesis. We just waited for them to resurrect, and we looked at the severity of their movement symptoms. So if we plot the walking speed of our resurrected RAs as a function of how long it took them to resurrect, we see a nice confirmation of our hypothesis. The longer it takes you to resurrect, the slower you are. This indicates that there must be some sort of what's called hypoxia-related damage to the brain. You starve it of oxygen, cells start to die. The longer you're starved of oxygen, the more extensive the damage. So that's one source of kind of the magnitude of the brain damage we see in CDHD. And yet we still don't know the root cause. And this is still the open mystery in science. What would cause a zombie brain? There's lots of potential candidates. We know that viruses attack the brain. I talked earlier about the rabies virus in cats. And this is the actual image of a patient who suffered from a rabies virus infection. It started in one hemisphere on the left here, traveled across the brain through a major connection called the corpus callosum, and went to the other side. So everything in white is damaged tissue. But viruses tend to be non-specific. They just kind of attack everything. It doesn't lead to this coordinated damage that we see in zombies. Bacteria will also attack the brain. This is an unfortunate individual who had a severe bacterial infection in their frontal lobe that ate away about most of their frontal lobe. But again, this is non-specific. Sometimes it'll affect the back of the brain, sometimes it'll affect the front of the brain, and it's also fairly easy to address once you know your infection. You just take antibiotics. But there are also non-biological entities that can attack the brain. For example, there's prions. Prions are little free-floating strands of proteins that basically disentangle the molecular portions of DNA and cause a cell to basically die. It's terrifying. You can't kill these things. They're not living. They're just little free-floating bands of proteins. Individuals who suffer from the disorder Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD, have these prions attacking the brain. So this is an individual who suffered from CJD. Everywhere in white is an area of the brain that was damaged as a result of the prion infection. It's pretty extensive, and it's also terminal. There's also other possible forms of infection. There are brain parasites. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, brain worms are real. This is an infection or condition known as neurocysticercosis. See where the arrows are pointing? You see those little circles? Those are little sacs that contain worms. It arises from when you eat tainted meat or food that was tainted with fecal matter. So it arises in areas with poor sanitation. And what happens is the little worm gets lodged up in your blood supply of your brain, makes a little home for itself, and just starts feeding off your blood. I know, creepy, right? Now, normally, if you have one or two brain worms, it's not a problem. Actually, a lot of people have these brain worms, and they don't know it. I wonder how many people are going to go get an MRI right after this talk. And the brain worms themselves don't cause much damage unless there's a lot of them. In some cases, of the really severe infections, individuals will have what looks like Swiss cheese brain, because they just have dozens of worms in their brain. But it doesn't really lead to that many behavioral deficits. And you can imagine a situation where maybe the worms start secreting a chemical that changes the brain, and that's something for a science fiction author to really run with. But in nature, there is a real zombie infection. There is a real form of zombieism in nature. And that's derived from funguses. In the insect kingdom, there's a whole class of fungus that will infect insects like ants, moths, worms, and make them do things, control their behavior in very surreal ways. So this is an ant that was infected with a zombie fungus. So this is the ant. This is the fungus that's erupted from its head. Before that little stalk erupts from its head, an ant that's infected with these spores will start acting strange. It'll start moving around in very odd ways. The rest of the nest will actually notice this. But what it does is this fungus makes the ant do something suboptimal. It makes it walk up to the underside of the leaf on a high tree above the rest of the hive, latch down with its mandibles, and just stay there to die. Now, this makes it vulnerable to predators, but from the fungus's point of view, it puts it in an optimal location to spread more spores. So after the ant dies, the fungus erupts out of its body and spreads more spores by populating them over the rest of the ant colony. And the new cycle of infection begins. This is real. So perhaps the source of the zombie infections in humans has some sort of a fungal origin. But we don't really know. And in fact, the only thing that science can really tell us about surviving the zombie apocalypse is that it's really okay to be creeped out by zombies.
Together. They're mindless walking corpses, and many of us will be too if you don't stay focused on the task at hand. Zombies, man. They creep me out.
So heed Dennis Hopper's advice. Be creeped out by zombies. It's healthy. Okay, so now let's step back into the regular world, the non-zombie infected world, unless you're ants and moths. I've just taught you real brain behavior principles. I've taught you about the neural systems involved in aggression, memory, face recognition, impulse control, spatial attention, language, and movements. But I've just couched them in this science fiction terms. Each one of those brain behavior relationships is real, and the best of our knowledge how the brain works. So this just shows that you can really leverage science fiction as an educational tool. You can repackage science to make it kind of fun to engage in again. And this approach to education has really taken off. Over the last few years that we've been doing this project, we've gotten a lot of media attention, including collaborations with the TED Ed organization for doing, we did some animated videos for them. We're working on a book coming up on the Princeton Press to teach neuroscience principles by framing it in a zombie kind of setting. And it's a really just interesting way to engage people in science again. So thank you for paying attention to my kind of odd odyssey through the symbiotic relationship between science and science fiction, how those of us in science today were inspired by the fantasy and science fiction that we read as youths, and how we can repackage that and inspire a new generation by really re-engaging that love for science and science fiction. Thank you very much.